Hello, good morning, good afternoon, good evening, whatever time of day it is when you're watching or listening to this. This is Carter and Moore, off script and on side. It's a new podcast in which we look at the stories, the passion and the power that drives women in sport.
I'm Brian Moore. I used to play rugby for England in the British Lions, and now I just write and talk about it. But today we're focusing on the 2025 Women's World Cup.
And I'm Jim Carter. I'm an ex-butler. I'm an actor, in fact, and a sports fan. And it's my great pleasure today to introduce our wonderful guest. She was one of the notorious Richmond Four. She co-founded the 1991 Women's World Cup, and now she's the president of the Rugby Football Union. That's me stuttering because I didn't want to say RFU, in case you didn't know what that meant. So please welcome Deborah Griffin, OBE.
Thank you for having me.
That's brilliant. Great to have you. Shall we start with today, with the Rugby World Cup, and move back? What do you think?
No, I think we ought to move back first.
Because
we'll show how far it's come, you know, in 20-odd years, just 20-odd years. This story is scarcely believable. I mean, when you hear it, as Deborah tells us about it, just put yourself in their position and think, if someone said to you, just do that, how the hell would you go about it?
You're talking about getting the
91 World Cup.
Women's World Cup, 91.
Yeah.
And to set it in a bit of context, the first men's World Cup, I think.
Was it 87?
Only 4 years earlier.
Yeah. And that was, and then there was a 91 World Cup in this country as well, in England.
Right.
And four women just decided, well, why can't we have one?
So, Deborah, we've talked all over you at the
moment.
Now
we're not going to tell the story. I started playing in 78, get them around the right way. And that was really probably the first game of the modern era, is what I liked, women's game of the modern era. And I just loved it. I thought it was the best thing I'd ever done. So I then encouraged lots of other people we all encouraged other teams to get up, other universities. We then formed the WRFU, Women's Rugby Football Union, in 83. And that was done really so we could get better fixtures, look at insurers and things like that. And I was a member of that right the way through, doing various things, treasuring, press and publicity and those sorts of things. And Richmond went on tour to New Zealand in 1987. So I think we were probably the first women's, at least from England, to go over there. And they were, you know, we saw what was happening there. We'd also had a few internationals and things like that. So we wanted, there was going to be a big club festival in Canterbury. And they were going to have a few international sides as well in the following year. And of course, they asked us to come, but we couldn't, you know, it would take them 3 years to raise the money to go the first time. So we certainly weren't going to go. And I don't think any other English sides. And I came back and I just thought, hang on, we need to get together. We need to bring all the countries together. So I wrote a paper for the WRFU. And they said, that's a really good idea. Go ahead and do it.
Off you go and do it.
Are you going to help? No.
Well, they did. They were very helpful. They were all volunteers. Yeah. So, you know,
What did the RFU say about this?
We didn't ask them.
Because you knew what they'd say?
No, I just think we were in our late 20s. You know, we'd been doing this throughout our 20s. There wasn't the internet or Googling or anything like that. So we sort of knew that there was an RFU, but we didn't have anything to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
That's the governing body.
So we just got on and did it. And I thought, well, how am I going to do this? And I looked to my club mates at Richmond, and there were three women who all had different skills, and I knew were doers and were people who would get on and help and do it. So I asked them if they would form this very small committee of four, and we got on and to do it. So we had no money. Sue Dorrington was responsible for trying to raise the funds, and she did, you know, we did an excellent job of putting out sponsorship packs and everything. We had got no traction at all. Sport England did give us some funding. I think it was about £10,000. We then took on a sponsorship agent, but they didn't get us any money either. You know, that wasn't down to the efforts they put in, but just it was, you know, it's difficult enough for women's sport now to get funding. Back then when we were nascent, we only, like, in 1990, I think we had 90 sides in England and Wales, and half of those were university sides. So it's really small. Alice Cooper was really good on the publicity side.
Alice Cooper.
Not that Alice Cooper. In fact...
Where have we gone?
Can I now call her Alice D. Cooper?
Yes.
To differentiate. She was brilliant. You know, she was a journalist. She wrote. And so we took her on to do the press, the publicity and all of those sides. Mary Forsyth, like myself, was an accountant. But I was going to do the logistical side of it, and so Mary took on the funding of it. And we just set out, what do we have to do? You know, literally almost, we didn't have spreadsheets, but it would have been largely a spreadsheet, a list of things that we had to do, divided them up. We used to meet in the morning before we, because we were all working, we used to meet in Mary's offices, 7 o'clock in the morning.
So would you just send the invites out to the internationals?
Yeah, well, we had to find, we didn't know who they were. Now, we had played France.
Yeah.
We knew the US had a team, they'd been over.
Yep.
We played Holland, we played Sweden. That was probably about, oh, in Italy, we'd played Italy as well. So we knew
so
they
had some contacts.
We had some contacts. And we just then sent off faxes. There wasn't any email, you know, and most of those have got nothing on them anymore. You know, I've got a whole Lever Arch file of plain paper, because fax, for those newer listeners, fades over time. You know, I just sent off a note, say, to the Japanese Rugby Union. I don't know how we even got their addresses, and said, "Have you any women? Can you send a team?"
So how many teams did you
get? So we had 12.
12 international.
So, you know, Japan did send a team.
And did they pay their own way? Could you pay for them?
Well, what we started off on the premises that they would have to pay to get here. But we wanted to pay for their accommodation, and their food and transport while they were here. And it was only going to be very basic, you know, university type accommodation. And that's what we went after. This was throughout 1990, and the tournament was scheduled for April 91, 6 months before the men's one was going to be held. And in the January, we realised we weren't going to get any funds. So we wrote to all the teams, faxed them again, and said, "Look, we're really sorry, we've tried our best, we can't do that. So it looks like we're going to have to call a halt to this." And apart from the French, who didn't reply to anything, everybody...
You've never been able to trust the French in anything.
We only knew they were coming 3 weeks before the tournament. Mm. Everybody wrote back and said, "We're still coming. We'll pay for it." You know, that was how much people wanted to be there.
Brilliant.
It was so...
Four of you on a kitchen table. I mean...
It became more... I mean, we had a lot more volunteers, around the event. There were volunteer team managers and people, match managers, and people selling the merchandise, all of these things, you know. So there was a bigger, wider audience, but it was basically the four of us driving it.
So you played at Twickenham in front of 50,000.
Oh yeah, sorry, not then.
where did it happen?
So when I set off trying to work out what we were going to do, I wanted to play it in somewhere that had a rugby focus, you know, that wasn't a football town per se. They had to obviously have university accommodation and have a good network of clubs. So I wrote and went to Leicester, Bristol, I think there was one other, and Cardiff, because the WRFU was Wales and England and Scotland in theory, although there wasn't really many Scottish sides at the time. And, you know, they were lovely in Bristol and Leicester, but when we went down to Cardiff, it wasn't just the union or the club. Well, it was the union, it was the club. They got the city in, the county council, Sport Wales, but I think they were called something else then. You know, they all were behind it. And that made a huge difference, you know. So they said, "Oh, look, we'll organise the opening ceremony." I mean, that in itself is, you know, massive. "We'll do a dinner at the end. We'll do this, we'll do that." So it suddenly, that was the obvious place to go, because
And it was in the culture and that.
Yeah, it's in the culture. The heartland of rugby, and, you know, I found out that at the time they were looking at tourism, and the whole city was looking at tourism and realised that the thing that they would get people to come to Cardiff for was sports tourism. Oh. So we were a little bit of the guinea pigs on that.
Can you tell us about the Russians? Because this is in, this is
my mind boggles to think of the Russians coming, Russian women coming here to play rugby in 1991 is an amazing thought.
It is, it is, and yeah, so they were in, you know, quite from the beginning, and they wanted to come and everything. Obviously, it was difficult to speak to them in many ways. It had to go through translators and things, but they said they would come in. And they turned up at Heathrow Airport, like the day before, and said, we're here. And they had no transport or anything. So we'd been, I think Ford loaned us some vans for the duration of the tournament. So some of our volunteers, plus Carol Isherwood, who was playing for England, got in the vans and drove up to Heathrow to bring them back. And of course, they all had these huge bags, and they were quite huge women as well. And they all had these huge bags. And the reason they had so much is because in they couldn't take money out of Russia. So they didn't have any money to pay for anything. So they had all these little Russian dolls, a lot of cucumbers, still don't know what that was all about, and and vodka.
Vodka, all right. Yeah.
And their idea was, which we didn't know about, was that they were going to sell this to in order to raise the funds here to do that. So they arrived, and then the next thing I knew was that, and we had to do loads for them because they, you know, they just didn't have it. Which, when you're organising something in 8 days and you're running around like mad, you know, just adds to the stress. And one of the things was I had a knock on my door in the early morning from, you know, the authorities, shall we say, saying that they were selling vodka
illegally
on the steps of the City Hall. And would I stop them, please?
Well, they've got to remember as well, I mean, this is 2 years only after the collapse of the, you know, the USSR, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
And I mean, I think, weren't you in Moscow in the same, well, not at the same time, but that year?
No, I was in Moscow in 91, the year of the World Cup. So that was why I'm amazed that they managed to come. Because, I mean, in August 91, there was a counter-coup attempt. The rump of the KGB sort of tried to come in, and Yeltsin was on his tank. And I was filming a spurious thing about Stalin that mercifully was put to sleep. And we were, our hotel was 200 yards from this underpass with bullet holes all over the place. And, you know, the trading, the bartering, we saw it because Moscow was incredibly poor. Nobody, when the communist system broke up, nobody knew how capitalism worked at all, apart from the gangsters.
Yes, apart from the gangsters and the government ministers, yeah.
Yeah, and our hotel was rubles for a beer, you know, pence for a beer, and suddenly the Chechen mafia moved in, huge guys and everything, $2. $2 for everything.
Did they have these? Because I toured Romania 3 months before Ceausescu got shot, and I promise you, you would never have predicted that. The secret police were everywhere, and what was incredible is you go past all these shops, which, and one of the reasons that this, it was central planning. Yeah, you'd have shops just full of pickled vegetables because they were surplus eating. And then you'd have these little doorways. And it just said dollar shop.
Yeah.
And back there into a big warehouse, if you had dollars, you could get anything you wanted.
Yeah. Well, I used to work in hotels and going around doing feasibility studies. So I did a feasibility study for a hotel near Varna in Bulgaria. Yeah. And Bulgaria is one of the last of those states to give up communism.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, you go into a hotel and... my job was to ask the managers how they operated, what sort of revenues they had. They didn't know. They didn't know because that all just went centrally. And then you go into a restaurant and they give you the menu and you go, no, I haven't got that. No, I haven't got that. No, I haven't got that. And all they ever had was ham and eggs.
So it was
ham and eggs for every meal.
Yeah, we go into the hotel restaurant, which is completely empty, the size of a gymnasium, completely empty, and kind of a man looking at us like this. And we said, could we have a seat? No, full. So the next day we went in and said, could we have a long, hard stare, please?
I mean, this all went through. In the end, the tournament was played. It was, you know, and was it USA?
USA won, yeah.
USA won.
Beat England in the final, is that?
Yeah. They had been, them and the French had been playing for about 10 years longer than we had, you know, and because of the...
Because their collegiate system, yeah.
Their collegiate system and the law that says they have to spend the same amount on female, they were very athletic. They weren't necessarily as good from a technical perspective, and that's been the case since in some ways, but they were
certainly
strong
and athletic.
Can I just
ask you, from there, I'm sure that you hoped the game would take off. Did you have a time frame by which you thought it might have, you know, wider popularity? And if so, would it have been, you know, would it have been as short as this period when we're going to hopefully have a sold-out World Cup final at Twickenham?
No, there was no plan. There was no strategy. In some ways, because there was no TV coverage really either.
Yeah.
So, you know, it wasn't getting out to the masses in that sense.
I mean, this current World Cup is getting great coverage.
Oh, it's incredible.
But you didn't get a lot of...
No, I mean, there were some really, you know, people like Stephen Jones and Chris Jones and David Hands were great. You know, they were always... But, you know, they were restricted by their sports editors in terms of what they could put in. So we weren't... And in fact, that's where the Russians was so... useful to us because it went out
talking
about
point.
This.
Yep.
It was a talking point. It was something that especially the local media and things could really get behind. So although it was a difficult circumstance, it was actually really beneficial. But no, we didn't have a plan. I think the reason for holding it was really to bring the countries together to show that we were, you know, and to talk to each other. There wasn't any plan from a participation perspective. Mm. And remember, the WRFU was all volunteers. We had no paid staff.
On the subject of media coverage, just going back a bit before that, I heard a clip the other day which made me laugh, and so I've written it down. I've got to read it to you. This is pre-1991. This is a radio commentary. And Martha kicks off, and it's taken by Hazel, and she's had her hair done for this match, and she looks just stunning. Commentary. Martha, Hazel, hair done. I mean, which brings us on to all the controversy with the hair bands and stuff.
Started
by men, So... You didn't get a massive amount of media coverage. So jumping ahead to now, let's get on to you being president of the Rugby Football Union.
Yes.
I mean, how long has the Rugby Football Union been in existence?
154 years.
And how many female presidents have there been, Deborah?
None.
And you're the first one.
I am.
We're going to pause now. Well, our viewership applaud. Thank you very much.
Well, we should also applaud the RFU and the people that have elected me, because...
No, I do think that's a fair point, actually, because... You know, if you want things to move, you've got to start somewhere.
You have to.
And you know, I'm not just defending my sport, but I also don't believe in knocking bodies unnecessarily. And everyone, the RFU does an awful lot in all ways, and it's very easy to say, you know, football's managed the greatest thing that Richard Scudamore did for the Premier League was he convinced football fans that anything went wrong was the FA's fault. Anything that went right was the Premier League's, was Premier League because of them. You know, and it's the same thing with the RFU, isn't it? Why aren't you doing this? Well, actually, you know, we're an minority sport, and, you know, I'm quite willing to write and give the RFU stick when they deserve it. But actually, the best professional league in the world was started by the RFU.
Yeah.
Most of the players who are playing here who are in the top echelon playing that league, and that wouldn't have happened had they not put the finance in. And you were looking at the...
And putting the funding in. It's still an investment case.
Yeah.
You know, we actually do, going back to your earlier point, did we have a strategy in 91? No, we didn't.
Right.
We have a strategy now, you know, and that's been going for the last 10 years. Mm. And it's being revised now
That's interesting, because look, I know about the legacy programmes.
Yes.
And I know that the home unions, which is Ireland, Scotland and Wales, have similar programmes to try and take what everyone hopes will be an uplift in the number of girls and women who want to play. But I'm just concerned about this. How fixed are those programmes? Will they actually all be seen through?
Yeah, I mean, we've had the Inner Warrior programme for, I don't know, 7 years, something like that, and that's still going on. So Inner Warrior programme is where clubs have a day where they invite women in who've not played rugby before, and there's a whole lot of exercises and skills, and it's designed just to make it fun and give people an introduction. That will carry on. And then there's an Inner Warrior League where new sides can join it from the beginning. They don't have to prove themselves, and to give them competitive opportunities. That will carry on. The legacy has been about match officials and coaching, and we've done 3,385 women have been supported in match officials
brilliant.
And coaching.
That's
I'm going to a match official and coaching course tomorrow, conference tomorrow at the Alliance, and that's across the country. Now, we have in place, but I'm going to make sure we have in place programs to support those women, because for me, yes, they're female coaches, they're female referees, but they're for the game. They're not just going to do. Some of them may only want to do female. Some of them may only want to do youth.
Yeah.
But if they want to be able to grow and coach,
it would actually be very beneficial for them to do both.
Yes,
because they see different speeds, different collision rates, and
so we have to support them to be able to do that, and that's infrastructure for the game, not just for the women's game. That's for the game as a whole. So there's all those sorts of programs. The money that we're spending, I think about $4 million has gone to our clubs for changing rooms, toilets, social spaces. You know, we're really lucky in England and the rest of the British Isles to have a network of fabulous clubs. Most of them have got their own clubhouses and their own pitches and things like that. But, you know, some of them were built a little bit of time ago. On Friday, I went up to Enfield Ignatians and opened their new changing rooms. £100,000 grant from the Legacy Fund. So they used to have 4 changing rooms, 2 quite small, and 1 set of showers, right? Now they've got 4 changing rooms, each with their own showers and toilets. It's interesting. I've opened lots of toilets this year, new toilets.
So is this your... Tell me about
that's
your
job.
That's my job. As president. You're president for a year, is that
yes,
right?
Yes, that's
so
right.
Are you opening changing rooms all the time? What are you doing?
It's actually like a 4-year term, because junior vice, senior vice, then you're president, then you're immediate past president. We work as a team. We've had a meeting this morning making sure that, you know, all the events and that. Yeah. So I've been opening toilets and changing rooms for a while now. And we'll carry on doing so, no doubt. And talking at dinners, at lunches and things. In your presidential year, you also chair council, so you're very much part of the governing body structure. You attend board meetings so that you've got that link as well. So there's a more administrative and responsibility in your presidential year.
Now, you said, if I can just go flip back a little bit, the Inner Warriors programme, you said so women could come along. So is that open to women? So you're saying you can enter this sport at any level. You don't have to enter it as a kid, that you're encouraging women who might think, I'm too old to start playing, because you can play for fun. You don't have to have international
ambition. One of our aims with this World Cup Legacy campaign has been under 12s. But, you know, that's not to ignore the fact that we want more women and girls. So, yes, I think, you know, in times gone by, most women started at university. We've now got, and it was quite a long time before we had youth girls and girls even doing mini rugby. But they're still joining at all ages. And I think we're used to, the coaches and things are used to bringing in women who haven't necessarily played before. I would hope, or I wish, that the men's game and coaches did the same. And some of them do. But, you know, they probably wouldn't come in such large numbers. But, you know, when you have a World Cup, when people see that, people go, yeah, I like that.
I mean, the biggest thing I think, there's been a jump in girls rugby. I think the next big jump will come. But the thing is, you need a critical mass.
Yes.
You have to have a certain number of players available to make a squad, to compete through a season and not drop out. And they need to be close enough to other teams within the area to have meaningful fixtures.
Yeah.
And this is why the bans in girls rugby go up in 2-year bits. Now, when you've got enough to do each year, like the boys, it will take off again.
Yeah.
Because the difference between 12 and 14, 14, 16, you know, that puts pressure on the 14-year-olds and so on and so on. But hopefully one of the big this would be my real wish, is if it spurred enough entrance girls to allow rugby at club level to have those differential each years, it would be a seismic.
Yeah,
it would be
I think we're some way away from that. Yeah. And at the moment, still a lot of clubs, the girls cluster, and that was something we introduced when we were in the RFUW, was clustering.
Yeah.
Now, it's got its pluses and minuses. A, it allows you to put out sufficient people, but of course it doesn't always encourage the clubs to still go off and form, get their own critical mass.
Yeah.
So hopefully this World Cup will allow that to happen.
How important, I mean, you talk about the legacy and what your hopes for the legacy. How important do you think a Red Roses win is to prompt it? I mean, do you think the coverage that this World Cup is engendering is sufficient to give it the boost, or would a Red Roses win give it a boost like the Lionesses?
It would be the icing on the cake, to be honest. Icing, it would all give us a great feel-good factor. But I think all the work that's been put in over the last 4 or 5 years and will carry on being put in, it will be helped. But I think we've put the work in so that, the things that we want to get out of this, which is more match officials, more coaches, more women playing.
More people at the bottom level.
More people at the bottom. I mean, that's actually what it is. All about the participatory level. I think will still happen.
But wouldn't it be great?
We still want to win.
wouldn't it be great in October if all the rugby clubs had all these girls turning up in pink cowboy hats first, and doing the rodeo dance?
Exactly. Well, the first weekend after the match, whether we win or lose, is a big rugby fest across all clubs for all boys, men's, women's. It's about celebrating rugby.
Yeah, but how have you found this? Because I know very well, because one of my mates, Jason Lender, was an RFU president, and he went to 100-odd dinners. You're to speak, was invited, and so on. You are quite often dealing with men who have given a lot of their lives up for their local club. They feel very proprietorial about it. You can't knock them because they've not been paid, and they have done all this unseen work and done that. But they're of my age, even harder, and they have views. Yep. That have been inculcated, from a completely different generation. How difficult has it been to persuade some people? Because I've always had very clear, I've been writing this for many years now, saying the success of rugby in general, including boys and men's rugby, in the medium and long run, will depend on developing the women's game. Not just because the numbers are there, it's because of the attitude of moms. If you don't think that moms have a direct influence on where their boys and girls, what sports they play, and there are lots of different sports to play, and if you get the best way to counteract stories about, and there are concerns about concussion, but they're not as bad as people would believe, and so
particularly
in the community game, the best way is to have mums who said, no, I've played, or my daughters have played, and that encourages. You can pull charts out, and say, statistically, you can prove this. People don't listen. But to have that, so I think, have they understood this, the male chairman?
Most. I mean, you're always going to get the few, but most have. There's an awful lot of female chairmen coming through, secretaries, treasurers, there's more and more. Some of them have played, some of them haven't played. They just love the game and they want to do things. I think that if you see a club where they appreciate that it's more members, and we've had it's been a more difficult in for the male adult game for the last 5-6 years, particularly with COVID, to keep the numbers up. But you can, if you have a women's team and you've suddenly got 20 extra members, you've got another day of bar profits, on a Sunday. Those sorts of things, the money talks, unfortunately, and it makes a difference to people. Yeah. Plus, you get more volunteers coming through. As you say, they're more likely to bring their kids along to minis and youth as well. So I see very integrated, very successful clubs which are providing rugby across the park, even walking rugby for those of us too old to, run around anymore. Those are the successful clubs. Is every club successful? No. Some are still having to do, and I think we need to do more around the governance as well of clubs. It's really interesting. If you haven't lived it, you don't know it.
No.
So like with men, they think they're doing the right thing, but they don't know what it's like to be a woman coming into a room where it's all men. They don't know that, you know, so they don't change the system, they don't change the processes, they don't change the governance to make sure that it's more open and more acceptable to women. And I think we need to do more to show some clubs what a successful club looks like.
And I think that's probably true in many sports. I think in cricket it's very true. For, I mean, I'm connected with an amateur cricket club. And I know recently, you know, there was a big report on equality, diversity and inclusion, you know, a really well-argued report. Very little of that filtered down to where we say hello to kids when they come into the clubhouse. Very little filtered down to the coaches and the parents who are volunteering to help those kids. So it was all signed off at the board level, but help us, tell us
if how I can to go back to toilets again, because it is my favourite. Well, it is my favourite topic.
Women's toilets need to be wider.
But they, you know,
they need to have bins.
I went down to a club and opened the toilets of early this year, and they said, what's really amazing, they said, is now we've got really nice women's toilets. We're getting far more corporate business meetings, wakes and things like that. And you go,
weddings and
you go, well, isn't that a surprise? You know, and yet they wouldn't have thought beforehand by looking at the toilets, which were a little bit manky. They just think, oh, that's just for the women. They don't really think about it. Now it's money. Now it's money coming into the club. It becomes far more important to make sure that you've got those. So it's that sort of not thinking about it that we need to change.
Sure. Blimey. Well, but the future's rosy. The future's good, isn't it? I mean, we're halfway, as we're recording this, we're halfway through. We've just finished the group stages of the World Cup. The feel-good factor I'm detecting is very strong. The scenes we see, Brighton looked like a festival town.
It was amazing. Yeah, it was amazing.
So the fan zone, were
you in there? I went through on Saturday and Sunday, went through the fan zone. Yeah. And it was spectacular. And the whole thing has been joyous. I think that's the word that most people are using.
That's a good word in sport, joy.
It is, it's joyous. Yeah. And, you know, when you look at the crowds and you see families, I'd be interested to know the split between male and female, because I think it's quite even.
I would think it's about 60-40.
Yeah.
Whereas generally it's about 80-20.
Yeah.
60 women, 40 men.
You know, the Allianz was built for 10% women.
Was it? Yeah.
That's why
I think it's probably...
Yeah. But, you know, so it's... What I do say about the game is that it's marketing rugby.
Yeah.
Yeah, obviously we've got our... outcomes that we want, you know, as we've talked about. But it's marketing rugby. People are getting the joy back in the game.
Well, the good thing,
Deborah,
is that I can genuinely say, and I, you know, my involvement goes back to 91. I just completely coincidentally was asked to help the England forwards in a session, just because it was in Richmond and I knew some of the girls and I went along. So it goes back that far. And
did you know him back in 91?
I knew who he was.
Not the Richmond connection.
Well, yeah, because he was drinking the same pub.
I was pregnant probably in the year that he was.
Oh, you heard it here first. Oh, my God. Mrs. Moore, we apologise.
I told you not to. Yeah.
Oh, God.
Right.
You anyway, heard it here first, bro.
And, I don't know where to go now. And
I've shut him up. That must be a first.
Where was it? Yeah, no. Yes, it was this. That you've got the Twitter that's full. 91, you're coming through. I've completely lost it now.
I want to shift this on. I want to talk now, if I may, a little bit of gossip. I think it was at Northampton. I saw you sitting next to the Princess of Wales.
It was in Brighton.
It was in Brighton, okay. Is she a rugby fan? Come on.
She's a sports fan.
Sports fan.
Yeah, I mean, she loves sports. Yeah. She wants all of her kids to try as many sports as possible. She was engaging. She was interested. She was delightful company.
But then you were slung out at halftime and Marley Packer took your place. I thought, now that's not right for the president.
No, it was all planned. And Jonathan Webb went one side the other because we had Zoe Allcroft came in as well.
Yeah.
it was all planned. Yeah. I mean, and I think it was nice. She was there. She arrived 20 minutes before the game. Afterwards, she went down to the England change room. She also spoke to the Australians, and then she was off. You know, so she wanted to have some of those conversations.
I bet that's more of a fun day than opening a factory that makes tractors. You know.
Now recovered. I remember what my point was. It was this.
Okay.
It was this. Throughout the years
it's
of the world.
Interesting.
Well, no, it probably isn't actually. But I'm going to say. I'm going to say anyway. Throughout the years I've watched, the first several World Cups, you know, you were watch. I was watching and thinking, please don't drop the ball.
Yeah.
Because I brought someone along to watch, and you know what?
Yeah.
The last few, and this one, and this goes all the way down all the teams. You're no longer looking at the fact that you're watching women play. They're playing. You're able to say straight away, that's good, that's not good, that's poor. You know, in the same way, without any sort of deference.
Do you know, I thought that myself the other day.
Yeah.
It was after
all the basic
after
skills.
Being in Northampton, and I watch all rugby, you know, men's, women's, boys, girls, everything. I love rugby. And I just suddenly realised that I was watching it without thinking it was women's rugby.
Yeah.
And even me, you know, and I just thought, that's good. I like that.
Yep.
Deborah, you were a scrum half, I think. And I think I know that you love tackling. What's your best rugby memories of either as a behind the scenes or as a player? What's the bit you think, wow, that was great?
I think it always has to be touring.
Touring.
You know, those are the players.
Come
those
on, you went to New Zealand in 1987. What was
but
that
we'd
like?
Been mainly to France and that. Been to Italy a couple of times. I never did some of the big tours to the US or Argentina, which I would have loved to have done. They're just places where you just bond with your mates, you know, and stupid things happen, you know, and you do silly
But they
things.
Stay on tour, don't they?
They stay on tour. Yeah. So I'm not going to give you any exclusives.
It's the same in the theatre. What happens on tour stays on tour.
You just bond with people when you're with them. And I'm sure the Lions is different. But I feel really sorry for the players who end up going into academies and pathways, that they probably lose that ability to tour in that way, because it's really special.
Yeah. I mean, that will be part of I think, of the answer to the question I'm just going to ask. What has rugby given you in your life?
Well, it's given me this, hasn't it? In a sense.
I mean, you must have been better moments than this, Deborah. But it's sweet of you to say.
I don't think she meant that, Jim. I'm sorry. I don't.
Yeah, it's it's been hard work and it's been challenging at times. But you know, going back, it is the friendships I've got out of it. You know, really lifelong friends, and I think that goes for a lot of people who play in the game, and that's what makes it special. I don't know why rugby does that more than any other sport, or whether it does more than any other sport.
I think it does.
I think it's the contact.
Yeah, physical
contact.
It's also this, Debbie, isn't it? It's the fact that it is one of the only sports where nearly every position is vital in an all team effort.
You're all valued.
You know, cricket, if you have a batsman who is simply but better, he can stay at his end, provided the other nine don't get out, the 10 don't get out. You can dominate with him with the bowler. You know, in rugby,
it's the ultimate team game. Yeah. Everybody
if the forwards don't do their job, the backs don't get the ball.
Yeah.
You know, it goes down to everywhere, and you know, vice versa.
Yeah.
You know, I still go away every year with a group of girls I played rugby with, 10 of us.
Fantastic.
You know, we had our 27th year of going away this year, and I know
which is the subject of a documentary soon.
Well, I hope not.
Yes,
but you know, it is that it is those friendships, that support. You know, shit happens in your life. But you know, you've got mates there who will back you up, keep, you know, look after you. And that's, you know, that's brilliant.
Deborah, I just want to say, to meet you, a mover and a shaker in the game, somebody who's got in right there at the beginning, and I don't know
still moving and shaking.
Still moving and shaking, especially on tour.
Known as the dancing president, because I love dancing.
Oh,
so
do you?
I always,
my God. Okay. did Bill Beaumont do any of that?
No.
Jason Leonard? It's been a delight to meet you. Thank you very much for joining us today on our podcast. It's been a pleasure, and I hope you've all enjoyed watching. Brian, have you any last words to say?
No last words. Just say thank you. Thank you very much. Just make sure all these things go through.
I'm doing really my best.
Good.
Doing my best.
Carry on watching the Women's Rugby World Cup. Enjoy it, and thank you for joining us today.
We're Carter and Moore, off script and onside, and we'll see you next time.